Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the A10 Talk Podcast. I'm Sam Basil, joined alongside today by David Korn, Kaylee Godek, and Thomas Aiello. Guys, we are back. The 2023-24 season starts on Monday, November 6th, for both the men's and women's college basketball season. I think by the time this comes out, it'll be the morning of the season opener. So, everybody, welcome back to Atlantic 10 basketball. We'll go back to college basketball overall, but, you know, obviously we'll be talking about Atlantic 10 men's and women's basketball. There's a lot to talk about on this first pod. First off, we've got our preseason rankings that came out a couple weeks back for both men's and women's media days. A lot of great quotes from media day, just about, you know, the state of the conference, their place in terms of the entire country, in terms of conference realignment, the transfer portal, and everything else that's continuing to change the landscape of conference sports. And also just, you know, a lot of excited discussion about, you know, this first week as we return to college basketball. So, guys, first off, how you doing?
I couldn't be more excited for basketball to start either, Sam. I think especially on the men's side this year, I think the A10 is as open as it's been in a while. I could really see a bunch of teams taking the title. I don't think there's a team, especially with VCU getting hit with some waiver decisions and injury decisions, I don't think there's necessarily a clear number one team. And I think that's so fun heading into conference play. I know there are issues with the overall strength, but I don't know. I think it'll be really fun to see these teams battle it out. And then, yeah, just can't wait to get started for another year.
Yeah, no, looking forward to year two. I've already gotten in with some of the women's basketball and UMass men's basketball. So really nice to kind of already get a glimpse of what both of those teams could look like after having a lot of players leave and also a lot of new players come in. So just trying to get a grasp of what those faces look like has been a lot.
Sam, you and I have been going back and forth most of the summer about the state of Fordham, the state of the Atlantic 10, the state of the Big East, the state of this conference or that conference. So now we are finally here. It is, the moment has arrived, folks, that we are going to finally put our money where our mouths are and talk college basketball. I could not be more excited for the upcoming season.
Yeah, we've been exchanging a lot of takes back and forth this summer. And like you said, I mean, this is our time to really get some of those on paper, or in, you know, this case, you know, the audio waveform, right? So let's start off with, you know, what I think is the most important thing, I mean, at least to me, and that was, you know, the preseason rankings on both the men's and women's side. So let's start off with the men. Dayton, you know, as they have in years past, really kind of ran away with the you know, consensus, you know, number one overall pick for, you know, the A10 men's basketball preseason poll. Out of 24 ballots, they were first place on 20 of them. VCU in second place overall had 3 first place votes, and St. Bonaventure had 1 first place vote. I mean, I feel like that was pretty interesting. St. Bonaventure obviously coming off a pretty tough season last year, where, you know, in 2021-22, they had, you know, they had lost a lot of longtime talent. They were really starting from the ground up. But now, you know, Mark Schmidt is kind of getting his team back into focus. He made some interesting acquisitions on the, you know, in the transfer portal. You know, if acquisitions is even the right term to be talking about in the context of the transfer portal, they brought in some really interesting talent. So a lot of people, it seems like at least somebody is pretty high on the Bonnies this year. Anything on the men's side that really stuck out to you guys? Anything, any team that you felt was a little way too high, a little way too low, maybe some sleeper picks? Kelly, what you got for us?
I'm going to say this right now. I feel that UMass definitely got put a little too low based off of just what I've seen already. Granted, yes, second straight year of having a really fresh faces in the program, like I've already mentioned. But also, I feel that this team could mesh together very well. We have South Carolina transfer Daniel Hankins Sanford coming in. Granted, we didn't get to see him in the exhibition game due to a stress reaction in one of his feet. He's already back, full practice. Don't think he played in the secret scrimmage against Iona, but from what I've heard, he's been really, really strong in practice and should make a great impact for the Minutemen, as well as Josh Cohen, who's transferring in from St. Francis, was NEC Player of the Year. So both of those players are going to bring some expertise, and Matt Cross has been really hitting the gym in this offseason and can really help make some damage on both the front court and behind the three-point line as needed. And also bringing in some really tall freshmen as well, with Mathuk Majok, who is 7'3", coming from South Sudan. He's only been playing basketball for 2 years, but it doesn't look like he's been playing basketball for only 2 years. So that is a really nice thing that we were able to bring in some key height, as most of our players are 6'6", between 6 foot and 6'6". So I think those three key players, as well as Robert Davis Jr. and Jalen Curry, should really have some key impacts on making this team finish up higher than where they were projected at 13.
Great point. I mean, one thing that you highlight, right, is the size that UMass has brought in this year. But one thing that stuck out to me, specifically with how that size is playing into UMass's kind of style this year. It seemed like in their blowout, I would say, of Western Connecticut in their preseason exhibition game, it seemed like they were a very fast moving team. They shot a lot of threes. They scored, according to the UMass Athletics website, they scored 35 points off of turnovers. That is a considerable margin. That's almost, that's almost, probably 40% of their total points for the entire game. How important do you think that is for this UMass team this year? I mean, especially, in the Atlantic 10, I mean, outside the Atlantic 10, where do you think UMass is going to, focus their guard play this year?
So from having talked with Coach Martin, in the post game of the Western Connecticut game, he said that he tries to gear the team based off of what the talents are. And this year, talents are definitely going to be behind that three-point line. If you look at how many threes we shot, I believe we shot almost 50 threes. We shot behind the three-point line a lot. Robert Davis Jr., as soon as he hit one three from behind that line, he was lights out with those threes afterwards. I believe the number for three-pointers in the entirety of the game was 47 threes attempted, with 18 of them made, and about six of those threes were made by Robert Davis Jr. And honestly, this team is going to be using a three-point line a little more than our past UMass teams, but honestly, there's nothing wrong with that, because we've seen UMass teams in the past where they've used the post – they like using the post players more, like when you had the Marcus Canby or Dr. J times. But also, you can look at the most recent team that was an NCAA tournament with Chaz Williams, Trey Davis, where they did use the three-point line more. So it depends, honestly, on what the team needs. And with the height being a little bit of a difficulty, I think we're going to be seeing the three-point line really being used as our strong suit. As long as they can stay hot from three, I think they'll be doing A-OK behind there.
Absolutely. And UMass obviously picked 13th out of 15 to finish, in this year's preseason poll. Then a couple other teams that I kind of want to get into here. I mean, first, let's talk about St. Bonaventure, because I feel like, specifically with how St. Bonaventure has kind of rebuilt their team. I think one of Mark Schmidt's quotes regarding the transfer portal at Media Day this year was probably one of the most important quotes, I think, from every single press conference that I saw that day. So I'm just going to read it to you guys right now. He said, quote, "In today's game, you can't win young. You've got to have a veteran team. You may disagree or agree with the portal or the NIL stuff, but it is here to stay. And if you don't adjust, you're going to die." And then he followed it up by saying, to elaborate a little bit more, he said, "You only learn by being put in those situations before." So basically what it seemed like Coach Schmidt was saying was, in a league like, especially like the Atlantic 10, where I feel like the teams that have come out on top these last couple of years are the teams that have stuck together for a long time. I mean, look at that Grant Golden, Jacob Gilliard, Richmond team, right? Those guys were together for five, maybe six seasons. So in a mid-major conference, you're not getting a lot of one and done straight to the NBA guys. So you want to have guys that can gel together. And then when it comes to bringing guys into the portal, a guy like Coach Schmidt wants to bring in players who, you know, while they don't necessarily have the experience playing under the Coach Schmidt system or the St. Bonaventure system, they have experience playing under similar coaching styles, similar play styles. And that is going to be, you know, for schools like St. Bonaventure and in the Atlantic 10, and maybe even in other, you know, mid-major conferences, that is going to be the driving factor for who gets pulled out of the transfer portal at mid-major schools. What are you guys' thoughts on this? I mean, David, I would like, you know, if it seems like, you know, GW is also pretty active in the transfer portal. I mean, how do you feel like this quote from Coach Schmidt describes the A-10? Is it accurate? Is it inaccurate? Or is it kind of a mix of both?
I mean, I think the transfer portal, whether you like it or not, is a reality. And I think that the era of teams sticking together is sort of, and having those groups that are really together for all those years is gone. And so I think for the most part, you need to, again, like, you need to figure it out, and you need to figure it out fast. And something GW has done, like you mentioned it, that I think is pretty genius, that I haven't seen a lot of other schools really try and sort of necessarily focus on, is GW has been targeting grad transfers and red shirts to ensure that you can have immediate eligibility, no waiver issues. And then for the red shirts, that they're, again, with the issues that have been, that we've been seeing with getting multiple time transfers, unless they're willing to sit out a year, they're with you for 4 years. So that's what GW's been doing. And no, there, this again, this year, there were no waiver issues for any of the transfers, because they were either all sort of red shirts or young transfers or grad transfers. So they've all had a lot of eligibility, or it's been able to go pretty quickly. So I know that's something that GW has been intentionally doing. Another thing that I think the Atlantic 10 can do in the transfer portal, and can sort of just do now in this whole new age of transfers and NIL, is to focus on international players, because of the issues that they have with securing NIL deals and how that's less of a factor for most of them. I think for a league like the Atlantic 10, that will sort of be able to give these players still some pretty high quality basketball without them maybe necessarily feeling like they're missing out on an NIL deal by going to a bigger school. Because I know that's a lot, that's an issue with a lot of these players. And I know I've heard from some GW student athletes, international student athletes, that for them, NIL, it's just like not really on their mind. Like, it's nice if it can come, but their main focus is on the basketball. So I think that's something where the Atlantic 10 can shine. So I think that's sort of where, as a conference, we'll see a lot of these transfers and how we sort of operate in this new sphere.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one thing that really stuck out to me that you said there is the concept of, like, multiple transfers, right? Like guys who transfer twice, maybe even attempt, you know, three times. And we've been seeing that a lot these past couple of years. But one thing, and I've thought about it too, I feel like we won't be seeing as much of that in, you know, throughout the rest of maybe this decade than we think we're going to see. Because, I mean, obviously this, we're also at a time where the era of COVID eligibility is kind of coming to a close, right? You know, guys are, you know, athletes are being able to play, you know, with a redshirt year, 5-6 years, and new players that are coming into the you know, college basketball machine are not getting that year of eligibility. Because, I mean, look, that year that was affected is almost 4 years ago now, right? So I think that could provide some stability. You know, guys will, you know, they'll transfer once, and then they'll really try to establish, you know, some continuity within their own program and within their own, you know, playing style. But I mean, who knows? I mean, Thomas, I know we've talked a lot about the transfer portal. Obviously, Fordham, you know, continues to bring in guys every single year. I mean, obviously, their incoming transfer class is highlighted by guys like Jaffe Madore from UTSA. So what are your thoughts? I mean, how do you feel like schools in the A-10 can kind of use the transfer portal to their advantage?
So this is a loaded question, Sam, and I want to step outside of the Atlantic 10 space and look at the Arkansas Razorbacks and look at what Eric Musselman has done in Arkansas. Last season, he tried to go with that freshman homegrown talent thing they didn't have as much success as people thought they were going to have. And someone, I at least had them going to at least the Elite Eight and the Final Four, I thought was their absolute ceiling. But we learned from them that, yes, good freshmen, the top 15, Jordan Walsh, Nick Smith, Anthony Black, this guy, like whoever he had, it doesn't matter if you don't have experienced college players that have played, like you said, in the college machine. And I think now with Musselman, he's got guys like Caleb Battle, who's one of their big-time transfers who came from Temple. They've got a Keon Menefield, I think, is the other guy that they brought in. They brought in a bunch of different guys from a lot of different places, but they've played four, five, sometimes six seasons in college basketball. And I think with Fordham in the Atlantic 10, and Keith Ergo really summed it up on Rob Doster's podcast a while ago when he was on, the Atlantic 10 is the silver lining if you're going to transfer, right? So if you're a power six guy, you don't want to drop to, like, let's say the NEC because it's too low of a level, but you don't want to go from the ACC to the Big East, right? Because that's too big of a challenge for you. You want to go somewhere where you can play and you can be a star, you can be an impact player, and that's the Atlantic 10. It's that silver lining. And we saw that with Khalid Moore, who's the best example I can give for that. And I think the next one we're going to see this year is when we go back to St. Bonaventure, like we mentioned, is Micah Adams-Woods from Cincinnati. He was like the fourth guy on their team, but he's going to Bonaventure and he could be one of probably their best player. And that's not to knock. He's not talented. He was just on a 23-win Cincinnati team who was in the American Athletic Conference, who was this close to an NCAA tournament bid. And now he's going to St. Bonaventure with Mark Schmidt, who we know is this wizard in college basketball with X's and O's. And he can do whatever he wants with whatever personnel he's got. He can adjust accordingly. And he's going to get the chance to really lead a team. And he's essentially a power six talent. So I think that's really what has made the transfer portal so vital to schools like the Atlantic 10. They get these power six leftovers, or they get these guys that were really good in the MAC or the Mountain West or these other conferences that may not be the Atlantic 10's level of reputation, but they were still competitive and still very talented. And they get the chance to prove that at a higher level.
So I think, first of all, you mentioned Arkansas. How could you talk about their transfer class and not mention A-10 legends, the Mitchell twins?
Oh, how could I forget? Shame on me.
Hunter Dean's children, also known as. But you you also, I think another player who could fall under what you were talking about is the transfer up, is Day-Day Grant, who I think was yes. another perfect example, who really started at Miami of Ohio, was looking for a transfer up, well, a place he could still have a big role, and he really was able to blossom at Duquesne, and I think he's their best player. And so I've spoken to GW head coach Chris Caputo about this very phenomenon, Thomas, and he thinks it puts the A-10 in a great spot as well, like you said, but it also provides a pretty big challenge for scouting these transfers, because almost every transfer that comes into the A-10 is going to have a significant role change. Either a guy transferring up is going to become more of a role player, or a guy transferring down is going to be more of a star. So it's really difficult for these coaching staffs to figure out who is going to adjust well to that role change. So that's something that a lot of them have been grappling with and has been pretty tough for the conference and this transfer situation overall, because we're in the middle ground. So yes, we are appealing to a lot of transfers, but on that same note, it is difficult to gauge how they will adjust to their new bigger or smaller role.
David, you hit the nail on the head. And I think one guy that at least I can think of, there's a couple through A-10 past and present. Fordham's got one guy who came from Binghamton. Okay. His name is Yole Akuovo. I hope I'm saying that right. Yole Akuovo. He's going to be the backup center to Simbila, to Elijah Gray. He's just a big body underneath. And Yole was the starting center for Binghamton last year for Lavelle Sanders. And like you said, the transfer up, some of these guys, Day-Day Grant's another great example. I can think in the past, I don't know if this is as much of a transfer up, but Marvin O'Connor, when he went to Joe's, came from Villanova, and he wanted a bigger role. So again, it's the same idea. Obviously, he's coming from a Big East school. But the A-10 is the good balance of, it's not competitive where you're just going to kind of run through everybody if you're an individual coming from a very talented conference or team. And it's not too overly competitive where you're not going to be able to do anything, right? So that's how a lot of these A10 coaches think now. And I think the one thing that also really stands out is the level of interconference competition that the A10 has had the last couple of seasons. I know Sam knows that I can go on for 3 hours about what's wrong with the Atlantic 10 and why the Atlantic 10 can't get more than two teams in the NCAA tournament. We can do an entire movie about that. Maybe we can call up Nicolas Cage or Brad Pitt. Maybe Rick Pitino will make some cameos and we can do a whole movie. But the point being is that players will come, leftover Power Six players that were just bench warmers or guys who were very talented in lower level leagues will come to the Atlantic 10 to have a very modest role or a very generous role and still be as good as they were in their previous conference than they were in the Atlantic 10. So I think that is a really big appeal to a lot of these transfers and these coaches when they go after guys, because they know that the A10's got a good balance of everything in between. I think that's what a lot of those transfers are looking for.
David, I'm glad you brought up Duquesne, because, you know, kind of moving into our next segment on like kind of the themes that I noticed at Atlantic 10 Men's Media Day, Coach Keith Dambrot had a really, really poignant quote about, you know, speaking with on what Tom was just saying about, you know, the A10 struggles these past couple of years to be a multi-bid league. Obviously, you know, we've been talking about it for, I feel like since I've been at A10 Talk, right? This is my fourth season with A10 Talk. There's always that worry that the A10 is going to be a one bid league. And that hasn't come true in a very long time, but it obviously did last season. So Duquesne, you know, finished fourth in this year's preseason poll. And by the way, I mentioned that there were 24 first place votes. I was wrong. There were 25, and Fordham stole one. Yeah, Fordham. I can't believe I forgot that. But Fordham, who was picked seventh overall in the poll, did get one first place vote. So I just wanted to correct myself there.
Just for the record, you know, I don't agree with that, obviously, as my previews will indicate. As they will indicate, me, the madman, of course, do not agree with that take.
David, you got one more poll gripe for us?
Yeah. St. Louis is way too high. Like, can we all see? Yeah, like they don't have a center. They lost their, I think, two best players. I'm not as high as Gibson Jimerson as a lot of people are. I think he's pretty one dimensional. And I think he really thrived because of Yuri Collins. And yeah, there are a lot of eligibility issues on that team. Six. I have them low pillow fight, so I don't really know what people were seeing there. And so before we moved on, I just kind of wanted to see that. Yeah, clip that, whatever, quote me. Unless something materially changes between now and tomorrow, or I don't know when this comes out, but unless, as of the day before the season starts, they do not have a center. That's problematic for a conference that I think the center depth is not the worst it's ever been. And I just don't like them. I don't think they're a very good team.
I want to just jump quickly on David's point, because I've been extremely controversial about St. Louis this year. The first thing to the ineligibility point, I don't think any of their freshman centers, because they're all internationals, I don't know if they're going to be eligible. I saw something, I think, from West Pine Bills. I forget, one of the St. Louis guys saying that all three of the freshman centers need waivers to play. I mean, that alone, like, I'm over here, like Gordon Ramsay seeing a Kitchen Nightmare restaurant for the first time. I'm already waving the red flag. Danger, Will Robinson, danger. And then you have Bradley Ezzurillo, who's coming from Georgetown, who was at LSU the previous season, and he may not even play.
Stu Durando said, as of 10:30 a.m. on the Sunday before Atlantic 10 play, Steph Van Bussel's the only big man who is cleared, but he is injured.
Okay, so yeah, oh yeah, Van Bussel's hurt, right? That's David's right. I forgot about Van Bussel being hurt. So, do you run Gibson Jimerson at center? Like, what does Travis Ford do? Does he call Stefan Lasame? He's 40 years old. He has one more year. He averaged almost five blocks at one point when Travis Ford was at UMass. He could do it. I mean, I'm obviously joking, but the second thing that I had that really got me some slack on the internet. I didn't put Gibson Jimerson on any of my all A-10 teams, and the people did not agree with that take. And shout out to Ghosty McHistory. They started the meme of zero Jimerson league. So that's because of me. Personally, I think, and David echoes what I was saying, no Yuri Collins is going to be a very big problem for a lot of these guys. Because Gibson Jimerson is a shooter. He runs off of screens. He can't play make with the ball in his hands. He's not some, like, I don't know. He's not Deonte Christmas from Temple, where he can just create on his own from all those years ago. He's not that dynamic of a player. That's not to say he's not talented, because he is, but he needs someone else doing the creating for him. So I just wanted to get that off my chest. I want to keep moving with the pod, but I'm sorry. The St. Louis take, it really does just drive me up a wall.
No, I mean, look, it's important to point out if that's how you feel about, you know, the state of the preseason poll. If I could, I mean, not that I was, you know, I didn't have a vote in this poll, obviously.
I wish we did, honestly. Could you imagine if A10 Talk had votes in these things, and just how, like, crazy the polls might look?
I think a lot of us actually have a pretty good gauge on this stuff, and I think it would probably be better. I don't know. I like us.
Yeah. I mean, I will say this. I do know that there's certain media members that do have that access to vote. I know one of the people that does stuff about UMass, I think it's Howard Herman. He's a reporter for the Berkshire Eagle. He was telling me about voting. Like, he didn't have UMass that low. He wasn't expecting UMass to be that low when I saw him at Mullins Madness back in the mid-October. So honestly, again, it gauges, like, it all depends. Because even when I mentioned it to Martin, he mentioned that he doesn't even know who votes for those things. So it may not be the coaches necessarily voting for this. It may be the SIDs for each of the programs doing the voting. But I have no clue. I highly doubt that it's the SIDs for each of the programs doing it. It may just be some reporters and, like, an assistant coach or something. But Martin doesn't remember voting for the preseason poll at all. I can tell you that.
So I feel like Frank knows. I feel like he knows the secrets.
According to A10.com, this is their direct quote: "The awards and poll were chosen by the league's head coaches and select media members."
Uh-oh.
So it's a mix it's a mix of the head coaches and, you know, selected media. I'm sure, like, a lot of the reporters for, you know, I would say probably like a reporter or two from each of the team's home market newspapers. I mean, that would make a lot of sense. But if, you know, say I was that lone voter that put Fordham on top, if I could find one criteria, I think, you know, in the same way that we're talking about, that you guys feel like St. Louis is too high, you know, the reason being, like, an almost complete lack of continuity, right? We don't know who's playing. We don't know who's starting. We don't know who's eligible. But with Fordham, you know, I think they have a lot of that, right? They have a lot of continuity from last year. They have a lot of, I think it's pretty clear on, you know, who's going to be in that starting five. You have a lot of returning players. You have Abdu Simbila. You have Antrell Charlton. You have that freshman class that's now a sophomore class of Noah Best, Will Richardson, Elijah Gray, Angel Montas. They're all kind of creeping their way up through the, you know, through the years at Fordham. So I think if I could find one thing that would justify that Fordham number one vote, it probably would be that continuity.
I just have a quick question about Fordham, and I think this is a great, with me here and then Sam, you and Thomas here, I think this is a great opportunity to ask this. I think Fordham and GW are in sort of similar but very different situations with their returning players, where GW is returning two of their top players, whereas Fordham lost their two top players. I think they're pretty clear two top players and are returning most of their depth. So I'm curious how you guys think Fordham will be able to sort of replicate the production you got from Quisenberry and Moore, whereas GW will be able to have a lot of that bulk scoring, but it's going to need to make up some of that depth. And so I'm just curious how you guys think that will be an impact compared to sort of, and hoping someone else maybe will step up, whereas, like, I know GW has that star power there already and is going to need just some depth to sort of make their way.
Yeah, so if I can be a little granular here, you know, you say Fordham lost two of their top performers. And I wouldn't really disagree with you by any margin, right? But I think when it goes, and while I think, you know, Darius Quisenberry and Khalid Moore contributed a lot to every aspect of Fordham's game last year, right? I think Darius was a huge contributor on defense for the Rams. I mean, he was really important in kind of, you know, setting that tempo. He drew a lot of charges. I mean, he was putting his body on the line, right? Almost every single play.
Didn't he pop his shoulder out during the tournament?
Yeah. I mean, there was, I feel like there was anytime he like put himself, you know, out on the court on the defensive possession, I was like, this guy is ready to get rocked at any time. And he would still get up. You know what I mean? But I think it's important to specify that they lost their two top scorers as well, because there are a lot of guys that made some big contributions to this team that weren't necessarily in points per game that are returning and that are really pillars of Fordham's identity on a lot of aspects outside of scoring. I mean, the number one example I point to is Kyle Rose. That guy has been on the team longer than anybody else at Fordham. I think he's my year, Sam.
What? He's my age. Like, I just graduated Fordham. He's my age.
Yeah, I think him and Albie Evans, right, are like tied.
Yeah, Albie came during the COVID year when they fired Neubauer halfway through.
Yeah, okay. So about the same. Kyle's got a year on him. I wrote an article last year right ahead of like Fordham's regular season finale, right before the Atlantic 10 tournament, where I described Kyle Rose was, if you ranked every player by their average box, like plus minus per game, Kyle Rose was at the top by a wide margin. And he was not, I don't even think he was in like the top three in scoring on the team. I mean, he is the defensive keystone of that team. And he's been there for so long under, you know, at this point, four head coaches, if you count DePauli, you know,
he was an interim head coach.
I mean, you know, look, I think the Jeff Neubauer years and the Neptune and the Urgo years are all very distinct in a lot of in many ways. But I think the number one thing that all these teams have tried to do for so long is establish just lockdown, really tough defenses, and that starts and ends at Kyle Rose. I think for a team like Fordham who prides themselves on their defense, like, that's where you start. And then, you know, you still bring in the solid scorers. I mean, you bring in Jeff A. I mean, he had a really good game. He had a pretty solid game against UMBC in that exhibition game. So I think when your focus is not scoring, it's defense, I think they're a little bit more comfortable, you know, kind of maintaining their identity, so to say.
I want to add to that as well, because my friends at least like to make fun of me for this, thinking Fordham could be one of the best teams in the A-10. But look, this conference is extremely feeble this year. Let's not lie. I mean, that could be a harsh way to describe it. But you look at teams like VCU, right? Sean Barristow is going to be out with the foot thing. And he immediately reminded me of Quinton Rose when he was at Temple his junior year. And he had a foot, a stress fracture. I think it was the same kind of injury. And Quinton Rose played through it, but he wasn't as effective as you would like him to be, right? And VCU also doesn't have Joe Bamisil or this guy. Dayton lost Tumani Kamara to the NBA draft. They lost a lot of their bench guys. We can keep going here because the teams, I don't think everybody did some form of a lateral more than they did jumping up. And I think with Fordham, is the continuity, yes, it's going to play a huge part of what they achieve. But the other thing too is everyone's freaking out, oh my god, where are the points going to come from, right? It's going to look more like Ryan Odom's Utah State team last year, right? There's going to be one guy who puts up like 14, and you're going to have three guys that'll put up 10. You got two guys that put up like 8 and 7. It's going to look something like that, because I don't firmly believe that Jafei Madore, and as good as he was in the UMBC game, he's not this 20-point scorer. That's not what he's going to be asked to do. Will Richardson going from 6 points to like 13 is what some people think he's going to do is an unrealistic ask a little bit, in my opinion. I think if they have around three guys in the 10-point range, you got one guy who's puts up his 14, and then everyone else just kind of chips in a modest offensive scoring role, I think that's a winning formula. And that's the big concern that people have is like, yeah, Quisenberry and Khalid Moore were extremely dynamic. They did everything for the team and they had a great defense, right? But other people are going to have to step up, and the in-house talent can do that. It's just, how high are they going to go? And I think that's what's scaring people away from putting Fordham in a top four or a top three spot. And honestly, as someone who observes the program very closely, I can see them still winning 20 games, but they're not going to have the 25-8 season again, right? The schedule is not as easy as it was last year. You have St. John's, who has Rick Pitino, Tulane, you've got North Texas, you got these guys, that guys. So they're going to get smacked in the face a little bit more, but they're still going to be a contending Atlantic 10 team in this year's Atlantic 10, which again is very weak. This could be the weakest one since like 2005. Okay. That's how bad this might be.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you come, I'm sure anyone listening at home realizes now, you know, we've got two regular Fordham guys on the podcast. So
the Fordham takeover. Come on, man.
All right. I'm just going to push back against something you said. You said people are scared of putting Fordham top four. I don't think it's really they're scared. I just think it's Dayton, VCU, St. Bonaventure, and Duquesne are a pretty consensus top four at this point. And so, I don't think it's something where it's like, oh, the Fordham too low jokes are ever present and people just can't see them. I just think it's like it's one of those things where they just, at this point, they lost their two top scorers. There are serious concerns, which you admitted yourself, about where the points are going to come from. And you outlined a path to it, but that is not a certainty by any means. And so you spoke in a lot of hypotheticals, which is great. But again, that is if everything goes right. There's also a world in which no one steps up. There's a world in which Kyle Rose has to take on a real offensive role, which I don't think he is comfortable doing and would be very successful doing. And, you know, this sort of everybody contributes becomes no one contributes. And so they could, everything could work out and it could be great, but I also think their floor is pretty low.
Oh, yeah,
don't disagree with you, David, at all. Just because kind of giving that a little bit of an outsider perspective as I kind of focus more on women's basketball, I can still give that perspective on men's basketball too, but I can tell you this, looking at it, like your stereotypical top four from just someone who's grown up watching UMass, you typically see a St. Louis, a St. Bonaventure, a Dayton, and a VCU with an occasional Duquesne mixed in there. So honestly, I'm amazed that Duquesne's within the top four this year, because Duquesne the past few years haven't been the best. But Fordham, from just growing up watching Fordham play UMass, I swear, no offense to my Fordham fans out
there.
I'm
taking.
But I swear UMass was always just smacking Fordham in the face every year as Fordham has not been good. And now we're actually getting to see a very decent Fordham team. So honestly, it's like just we don't see this that often from Fordham. So there's a lot of up in the airs about whether they should be considered a top four team, probably just because the consensus again this year was St. Louis, Dayton, St. Bonaventure, and Duquesne, I believe, is what David said. So honestly, there's a whole bunch of different programs. And again, it is going to be a funky year in the A-10 just based off of a lot of changes.
A great point, KG. I think, yeah, I can't disagree with you guys there. I think you're exactly right. And you as well, David, in saying that, yes, we have outlined a path. But at the end of the day, and I think Fordham knows this as well, at the end of the day, you don't win basketball games by, you know, allowing the least amount of points. You win basketball games by scoring the most points. So yes, we've outlined their base, but we do admit that there are guys, you know, there is going to have to be somebody to make that, you know, that jump. Speaking of, you know, the top four, KG, you mentioned Duquesne, and you know, I really wanted to get into this quote from Coach Dambrot that kind of talks about the state of the Atlantic 10 in terms of how each of these schools, you know, prepares their own non-conference schedule in order to put themselves in the best position and also the conference in the best position, right? So he said this, quote, "This league puts a lot of money into basketball. There's about 4 to 6 at-large bids for mid-major teams like us. The key to it is the bottom to the top all have to be good, and we all have to win in November and December." Then he kind of gets into, you know, bringing in top 75 teams throughout the season, you know, quad one and quad two wins. And then he finishes it off by saying, a road win in the Atlantic 10 is just as hard as a road win in the Big 12. And 7-10 or 8-10 is getting, and he means 7-10 or 8-10 in league play, is getting you in the tournament in the Big 12. And 13-5 is not getting you in the NCAA tournament in our league, that league being the Atlantic 10. Coach Archie Miller also made certain comments saying last year that, you know, the league really didn't set itself up well, at least from a Rhode Island perspective, did not set itself up well to, you know, have a really good run in November and December. So it seems like the general consensus is that while the teams need to try harder, the 15 teams in the Atlantic 10 have to try harder to schedule high quality, you know, resume building opponents in November and December. Sometimes it's a lot harder for them to do that because these power five, power six leagues, and even really good mid majors are a bit more reluctant to do that. And then, you know, make their way into the tournament as an at-large team through the benefit of being in a really good conference. So, I mean, I would love to hear from you first, KG. Do you kind of agree with this? Do you feel like, you know, the way that conference realignment is going, and as conference in league schedules get longer and longer every year, it's kind of leaving a good mid-major league like the Atlantic 10 in the dust?
I mean, honestly, that is a loaded question. I will say that, just kind of thinking about it, we are seeing the Pac-12 literally dissemble before our eyes, as a lot of them are shifting over to some of the other power conferences. So Big Ten, SEC, but a lot of shifting, and it's just crazy. But I mean, this could hurt a lot of mid-major conferences, like the A-10 could hurt the American Athletic Conference as well. So, as well as the Coastal Athletic Conference, aka the Colonial Conference, as now that's a new change for the name. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going to be a lot for mid-majors and those lower majors as well, just to try to readjust to all of this. So that's where the thing of having a little bit of a longer conference play is going to hurt some of those teams. And honestly, it's this year, I can tell you, there's not many power six schools on UMass's game list. Like, the one that is scheduled for sure is against West Virginia. And honestly, West Virginia isn't looking as like strong as some of those other teams, just because of losing Bob Huggins in the offseason because of some inappropriate stuff that shouldn't have happened. And also losing like a lot of star players to the transfer portal. AKA, we don't get to see Trey Mitchell versus UMass now, unfortunately, in December, which I was looking forward to. But honestly, it really does both help and hurt those teams. Like, if they can't get those power six teams to agree to play them, that's where it really hurts those mid majors, like a UMass or even a URI, if they can't get those teams to really agree to it. And I'm just going to say this, and this is going to be a bit of my rant, I will apologize, but UMass cannot seem to get BC, Providence, or UConn on their schedule. I was just talking to some people up at the UMass football game, and they were complaining about not having a UConn game for either men or women. BC is actually playing the UMass woman this year, and they've played against the UMass woman for a few years now. And also Providence hasn't agreed to play UMass either since Luan Pipkins transferred to Providence. So honestly, that goes to show you that UMass, just the local like power six teams, don't want to play UMass just because UMass has handed them the butt too many times. But that is what it is.
Thomas, I know you have something to say, but that reminds me of specifically a quote from Chris Caputo at Media Day, where he was specifically talking about how tough it is to schedule other teams in the DMV, teams like Georgetown, teams like American, teams like even George Mason. I mean, obviously they got to play George Mason, but, you know, just throwing those teams in the mix. How do you feel, David, you know, as a GW, you know, student, a GW fan, a GW reporter,
GW graduate at this point.
A graduate, excuse me, sorry about that, but about scheduling these, you know, for fans, really fun non-conference games.
So you mentioned a few schools, and this isn't a few school problem, this is a Georgetown problem. The other schools in the area have been willing to schedule GW. GW played at Maryland 2 seasons ago. GW hosted American and Howard last year. And Chris Caputo has been on record saying he is willing to travel to those locations to play at their arenas as well. But there have been some issues with money. But those conversations and games have been happening. This is a Georgetown issue, okay? I don't want to blame any of those other schools. Georgetown is unwilling to play GW. I have not heard any update on those conversations with their new coach and change with Cooley in and Ewing out. I think honestly with Ewing there's a better chance of it happening eventually, because I know Caputo and Ewing had a pre-existing relationship and Caputo told me that he was working on that. But at this point, it is a Georgetown issue. And I think with the out-of-conference scheduling, I think that teams should prioritize winnable games that, again, just the way the A-10's looking. I know this isn't great for a league perspective, but teams should selfishly focus on easier, winnable out-of-conference schedules that allow them to prepare themselves best and figure themselves out the best before conference play to make sure they are in conference play as healthy and ready as possible. And I think the best way to do that is to allow yourself more time to sort of experiment with rotations, maybe give guys a bit of rest, and yeah, focus on geographic rivals. You know, I love that Fordham and St. John's are playing. You know, focus on the local teams, try and get some local interest going. Maybe if you have any historic, you know, rivalries, like anything like that, get those in there, go to alumni bases, anything like that. But at this point in time, you know, it's Power 5 games and group of, like, Power 6, those games are a lot of fun. But I think the reality is they just aren't happening as much anymore. I think the priority is, should be geographic rivals. And I think another thing that the Atlantic 10 should do is find another mid-major conference. I love the Mountain West, for example, and develop a relationship with them where you do a sort of A-10 Mountain West challenge. I think that would be great, where you guarantee another quality out-of-conference opponent, maybe get a good road game and a good home game in, something like that. I think that would be a huge next step as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. Tom, what you got for us?
Well, I'm going to regurgitate what John Rothstein said when he was on Frank Martin's podcast, and KG's going to know exactly what I'm going to say. Frank Martin said when he was at South Carolina, he was told not to schedule the Atlantic 10. You know why he was told to not do that? The Atlantic 10, I'm going to use an old-fashioned term, the Atlantic 10 teams, the risk of losing to them, the modern iteration, is too much of a risk to the Power 6 teams that they would beat, per se. It's almost like the A-10 is still RPI poison, right? I know the RPI is, that's an old school term, but it's true, because imagine if St. Joe's played like Michigan State, right? And let's say Billy Lang somehow beats Tom Izzo in some magical world. The hit that it would take to Michigan State's reputation as a program and to Tom Izzo and to that team that he's got this year, it'd be too great for them. And it could have really hurt their chances of getting a high seed in the NCAA tournament, which is what they go for every year over there. So that really puts the Atlantic 10 already at a disadvantage, not because they're not good enough. It's just the other teams don't want to run the risk of losing to you. And this one is a very common complaint that has been a thing for years. The 18-game league schedule is completely counterproductive for what the Atlantic 10 has been trying to achieve. We're very far removed from 2013 and 14, 5 bids, 6 bids, 4 bids, I think, the year before. And now we're lucky. Yeah, 6, right? We're lucky to get 2. Now, in this Atlantic 10, we're lucky to get 2. So there needs to be more leniency with in-conference play. We have 15 teams in the Atlantic 10. And the commissioner has expressed her desire, if need be, to add a 16th team. Just play everybody once. I understand you're going to lose in-league revenue, but if you want, everyone complains about the Atlantic 10's national image, get rid of the 18 games, because nobody wants to do that. You want the A-10 to have multiple bids, 18 games, and if the American implodes on itself, call Temple. Just call them back. Be like, hey, like, play Marvin's Room, something. I don't know. Act sad, and maybe they'll come crawling back, because the Atlantic 10 needs its biggest brands to do well and to schedule tough out-of-conference schedules. And Temple needs the Atlantic 10, if you have been following recent events in North Broad Street, where their interim president was forced to resign, and then the interim, replacing the interim, tragically passed away. The football program has like 10 people at Lincoln Financial Field every single game. The basketball program is now horrendous. They need their big brands to perform, right? And that's not just if you call Temple back in my crazy hypothetical. You need Dayton to do the same thing. VCU, St. Louis, UMass is a national brand because of what John Calipari did. GW, I know, has a lot of national pull. You need your biggest brands and teams to do well, and you have to give them the chance to do that. That is the only way the Atlantic 10 is going to have any national success, or you're going to play these Power Six schools and they're willing to come play you, because yes, they can probably still beat you, but it's still a healthier competition for everybody involved. That, again, this is another rant of mine, but that's really, it's that simple of a fix. And why we haven't done that yet is a little beyond me. But again, I know there's other factors, but that's really the simplified version of how to fix the conference to get these Power Six schools to play you.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you whatsoever, Tom, just because this season, actually on the women's side, they just bumped us from a 16 to an 18 game conference play. So personally, I think the 16 game was better just because you're only playing two opponents twice, because there's 15 teams. You're one of the 15. You only play two of them twice. So that means you get to play like your conference rivals. So UMass with Rhode Island, St. Joe's and LaSalle would always play twice. And then like your George Mason, George Washington will always play twice, just because those are just the rivals within that area of the conference. So it would make sense. But now kind of seeing it bump up to 18, we actually have our conference play on the women's side start up on December 5th. December 5th, we have, I believe, two or three games going on that are in conference play. I don't remember what teams exactly, but I know that we have games on December 5th. Honestly, that is blowing my mind. I see that I just blew your mind a little bit too. It's too early, but same time, it's just because that's how they can fit these 18 games in. And if I'm going to be fully honest with you, I feel like we should have stayed with the 16 games, just because the women's season ends before the men's season ends. We end a week earlier as we start our conference championships for women's basketball the last weekend of that men's basketball season. So honestly, seeing that shift on the women's side to the 18 game kind of does hurt the resumes a little bit for the women's side, who have been fighting to try to be a two-bid league, but the selection committee for the women's side is more biased towards those Power Six conferences, even if they're at a 500 record. Because may I just point out, last year, UMass was one of the first teams on the first four out list and then got named as an automatic qualifier into the WNIT. And honestly, UMass could have had a few winnable games on the women's side into the NCAA tournament, but didn't, just because of, well, they're going to favor those Power Six teams more. And honestly, it sucks because
I don't think UMass had a few winnable games in the tournament. I think
a lot of people were saying it. I didn't agree with it.
I think they would have been a one and done, just like all the other A10 teams usually have been. But
I mean, you're not wrong, but I didn't agree with it. Some of our other reporters kind of were thinking it a little bit. And then Tori was mentioning it a lot, that we could have possibly won a game, but I think we would have been one and done just looking at it. But also with their also talk about the change of the NIT tournament this year on the men's side, that is going to be huge on the A10. And it's going to hurt a lot of postseason for a lot of mid-majors and low mid-majors for this. So honestly, there's a lot of stuff that has changed just in this year alone in the offseason that's going to hurt mid-majors, and that's going to hurt those low-major teams that had a chance at postseason play just because of changes in the NIT.
Absolutely. To put it into perspective on one thing that you said about UMass, is the beginning of the UMass women's conference schedule. I believe you said it was on their conference schedule starts December 5th. For Florida men's, their conference schedule starts January 6th. So that's a whole 32 days before, you know, it's unreal. Finishing up on the men's side, I just want to do a little, you know, just give me, I want everyone to go around and give me one bold take about A10 men's basketball this year. Let's start off with you, Aiello.
Oh my God. Of course I'm getting pushed into the center here. My bold take, and I'm not hiding it at all, I think Fordham is going to win the regular season title. That is my bold take. And my, I guess I'll give you a second one. My second bold take is LaSalle goes to the semifinals of the tournament, the A10 tournament. I fully believe in the magical powers of Fran the Wizard Dunphy. I fully believe he is like a teacher at Hogwarts part-time. He teaches magic with the little wands and Daniel Radcliffe and Harry Potter. I feel like he is the wizard of this conference. Because he, what is he, 75? I think he's 75, right? He went to the quarterfinals last year with a, what most people saw as a pretty horrible roster. And they went, they almost beat Fordham in the quarterfinal game. And I think his personnel this year and his reputation of player development, he could really, they could make noise, the Explorers. They've got a fun little team. I know that Matt McCall said this on the A10 Insiders pod with Jeff Goodman. And I, maybe Matt McCall reads my previews. He may, maybe, I don't know. I don't know where he gets his information from, but I believe like Fordham wins the regular season title and LaSalle is going to play spoiler in the Atlantic 10 tournament and go to the semifinals. Those are my two hot takes.
Fordham wins the A10 regular season record with what, or the A10 regular season championship with what in conference record?
Let's go. We'll go I'm going to go 12-6 again, because I feel like that's what we're going to see from a lot of these teams this year.
12-6 regular season champion. Interesting.
I look again with how ridiculous this conference is probably going to be in conference play. To quote again, John Rothstein, the A10 is going to cannibalize itself. 12-6 could win you the regular season title. It honestly could. It really could. I don't think anybody is drastically better than somebody else. I don't think the teams below are in that pillow fight area are much better than each other. And I don't think Richmond is good, but Chris Mooney does like to troll everybody every year. So again, who knows? With it, for all we know, George Mason could win the whole damn thing. They could. They honestly could.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, no, I don't. I'm just saying.
I think I can. I will. I don't. Again, I'm pretty confident George Mason not going to win.
No, something crazy could happen. Like, I'm just saying, that's the kind of year that we're all set up for right now. So who knows? For all we know, A10 Talk could have a team and we could win 15 games. I mean, that's the weakness of this conference. That's my hot rant here.
David, what could you counter us with? That was a pretty high bar for some preseason hot takes. So I would love to see what you've got cooked up for us.
I think that I personally don't think this is a hot take, but I know this is a very controversial take with a lot of people, and this stirs up a lot of emotions. I think James Bishop is going to be player of the season, and I think he will play himself into draft consideration and will end up on an NBA roster at some point next year. That's one of my hot takes. And then my other hot take is I don't think VCU finishes top four. I get it. It's VCU. They won it last year, but they lost so many players. You know, Bamisol, who I thought was going to be their leading scorer, out. They have injuries. You know, people are just assuming that Odom's transfers that he's bringing in with him from Washington State. Like, they don't consider that, you know what, that still is a transfer. You know, that still, they have to build up that chemistry again with a whole new team. And I really just don't. I understand why. I don't buy it 100%. So those are my two big hot takes.
Ooh, so I'm going to definitely agree with David. VCU is not finishing within the top four. I'm sorry. This is just such a funky year for VCU with a new head coach, a lot of like people transferring in and out, also with Joe Bamisol getting his waiver denied. I think that's definitely going to be a huge one. But my hot takes that I have, this could cause some UMass Twitter blow up, and I think it'll be good UMass Twitter blow up. I say UMass finishes top four against all odds, considering placed 13th.
Oh my God.
What? Oh my God.
As long as they can stay healthy.
It's hot take time. Let's hear KG out.
As long as we can stay healthy, and if we can get, if Sawyer Mayhew does enroll in UMass in for the spring semester, I feel like we could see something there just because of just trying to figure everything out. Granted, yes, young team. May I just point out, 7 freshmen on the team, one of which is a walk-on, one of which is not even a scholarship player. It's definitely going to be really heavily reliant here on our freshmen with the natural Robert Davis Jr., with Jalen Curry, and also Mathuk Majuk. Those 3 players are definitely going to be heavily reliant on probably in minutes for the freshmen. But you're also going to see your experienced players like Matt Cross, Daniel Haken, Sanford, and also Josh Cohen really step up, and they can really probably produce valuable minutes along the way. And with mentioning those 3 players, Haken, Sanford, Cross, and Cohen, I would say those 3 have, I could see them possibly making either all conference first, second, or third teams. So I have 2 hot takes on the UMass side, and I saw the blow up come from the top 4.
Is Reindeer gonna die on the spot when he hears this take? I mean, he might just be. Oh man! Oh my God! Wow! That puts my Fordham take to shame, KG. Good for you.
Wait, I have another hot take. Actually, I think Josh Cohen's gonna average like 10 points a game. I don't think he's gonna be very good.
Wow. Okay.
I'm not sold on it. That's going to be my hot take, that Josh Cohen is going to be an average player at best in the conference.
Granted, Cohen only played in 13 minutes in the exhibition game. He did score 6 points and did produce valuable rebounds, both on the offensive and defensive side.
That sounds like an average player to me. I don't know.
Average player. But he also, if he had played in the second half, I feel like we could have seen a little bit of a difference, but he did tweak his back sometime in that first half, and Martin did not want to play him in the second half just to make sure it wasn't anything major. So, you never know.
I have one more hot take.
So, all right, what you got for us?
Anthony Grant plays point guard for the Dayton Flyers.
You know what? I know eligibility is kind of a weird issue right now.
He's got one more year. He could do it. He could.
It's like a J.R. Smith situation.
Yeah, exactly. Anthony Grant just subs himself in and just starts bombing threes. That would be fun.
You know what? You know, with the way that eligibility is, I feel like anything can go at this point.
Played too. He could play. He has a couple of years of eligibility left. He could run some point.
I feel like I had a couple. I feel like some of them weren't too hot, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw either VCU or Duquesne in the championship game this year. You know, I think VCU's got a tough, you know, they, you know, a lot of changeover, but I like Ryan Odom. I really liked his, you know, I really liked how he was, you know, kind of setting up this team. I really like the way that he's kind of handled, you know, like kind of rebuilding this team's culture. And I guess my other one is, and you know, this is just, again, based off of just, you know, kind of vibe checking coaches at Media Day this year. I think Loyola Chicago, I think last year was a bit of an anomaly for them. I think coming into a new conference is always going to be really tough, but I could see them winning 10 games in the Atlantic 10 this year. He had a really good quote at Media Day. You know, I'm really all about the quotes this year. Basically talking about how the biggest thing that he learned in year one heading into year two is that the team, he really needed to rework the entire team's identity, right? He explained that in the Missouri Valley Conference, to win in the MVC, you really needed to be what he called a chameleon. You had to adapt to a lot of different play styles from a lot of, you know, very, you know, unique, diverse teams. And while that works in the MVC, and, you know, sometimes it can work in the NCAA tournament as well, because, you know, you're playing teams that you might have never even, like, played in your life before. You might have never even seen in person. In the A-10, all these teams have such an established identity that these coaches have been developing for years and have, you know, they're, like Mark Schmidt said, they're fine-tuning their picks out of the transfer portal for. So, you know, he really needed to establish that identity, which, you know, for the A-10, it's very defensive. You know, it's kind of scrappy. So he's got to really do that with this year's Ramblers. And I think they'll adjust. I think, you know, they'll still be able to kind of be that chameleon, and they can go 10-8. Let's kind of finish off with one of our last segments of the night. And let's get into all the women's preseason basketball polls and awards. I think pretty standard, you know, nothing crazy that was a bit that was unexpected in this year's preseason poll. You know, let's just round out our top five: Rhode Island, St. Joe's, St. Louis, Richmond, and Duquesne. Rhode Island, the clear favorite. They got 12 first place votes. St. Louis, who came in third, got two first place votes. And Duquesne in fifth got one first place vote. KG, you're obviously our leading you know, women's basketball expert on the blog, you alongside Daniel Frank. Could you kind of explain your initial thoughts on this preseason poll and where you think teams might, you know, move up or down throughout the season?
Really, Rhode Island being chosen first to the conference isn't anything that wasn't unexpected. Yeah, Rhode Island did. This is going to be, here's the emphasis. They won a share of the conference regular season title. A share. Rhode Island being chosen first, honestly, kind of expected at this point. We're going into year four or year five of Tammy Reese now at Rhode Island. So, honestly, I could see if Rhode Island has a good season, which, honestly, I could see happening. We're going to have a really strong year from Rhode Island, and we could be seeing some players like Sophie Phillips and Maya Torre really have a huge standout season with the Rams, but also looking to St. Louis at third. I'm sorry, I was not expecting to see St. Louis at third. I was kind of expecting St. Louis to be second. I can see, or not second.
I was expecting St. Louis to be a bit lower. I mean, I thought so much of what they did last year was based on Brooke Flowers being, I think, by far the best defensive player in the conference. And I think the single most important player to any team, men's or women's side, last year. And I think people are kind of forgetting how important that was and how really impossible it was for teams to score in the paint against St. Louis last year. And so I think her graduating, I mean, she's staying with the program, right? She's an grad assistant, I think, but
grad student manager.
But I think that I was really surprised to see St. Louis that high. And I know they have other good pieces, Martinez, whatever, but I didn't, again, I'm really ragging on St. Louis today, but I was surprised to see them that high.
But honestly, I would say this too. We had them in A10 Talk released our power rankings for the preseason for the women's on Friday. We had them at second. So I wasn't expecting them to be, like, again, a repeat of last year. They just won their first ever conference title. Rhode Island hasn't even won a conference championship in the tournament yet still. That is one thing I will point out. Rhode Island could finally get it this year. Who knows? And honestly, I will say we are also seeing a little bit of a different bottom five this year on the women's side too. UMass and Fordham are both in the bottom five for the first time in several seasons. Both teams have new coaches. So we have Coach Mike LaFleur on the women's side, who's actually stepping up from being an associate head coach at UMass up to the actual head coach position after being with UMass for five seasons. So there's a little more familiarity with the UMass program than Fordham has. So I was expecting UMass to kind of be down in the bottom of that, just because we saw Dayton last year get put in 10th after their coach got hired at Illinois, and then they brought in a new coach. So honestly, seeing that, it does happen, but it'll be interesting to see where both of these teams like end up. Anna DeWolf is no longer with Fordham. She'll be making her Notre Dame debut tomorrow against South Carolina over in Paris, fun fact enough. So that game is going to be a very interesting game to see. I know that's not an A-10 game. I'm actually going to end up probably watching it for a little bit just to see it being played, because this is the first time an NCAA women's basketball opener is actually being played overseas. So it's a really cool thing, really nice thing to see. And then just kind of joining in the bottom five with UMass and Fordham, LaSalle and St. Bonaventure joined with Loyola Chicago round out the bottom five. LaSalle lost all of the Jacob sisters to the transfer portal in this offseason. So this year is definitely going to be a down year on LaSalle. So it's going to be interesting to see how they can really face up against some of the other teams. St. Bonaventure just had a coaching change this upcoming year from this past season. They fired Jesse Fleming mid-season after, I believe it was a 3-14 start in non-conference play, and then having an 0-2 start in, I believe it was like an 0-something start in conference play. I don't remember the exact numbers, but they fired him. They had someone bump up into the interim head coach position. And then in the offseason, they hired back Jim Crowley, who had left St. Bonaventure after 16 seasons to go coach at Providence for 7 seasons. He's now coming back for a second stint. So the St. Bonaventure program could be coming up in the next few years, but it's going to be interesting to really see what we have on this. Just because there's a lot of like differences in a lot of these programs. And I was talking with Josh Schreiber, who's a friend of mine from having done a lot of stuff at UMass. He's really like been like, UMass has a lot of winnable games, maybe minus the top like five, which are Rhode Island, St. Louis, St. Joe's, Richmond, and Duquesne. Maybe even George Washington will be a winnable game this year, but he's saying the rest of it is winnable. It's going to really depend, because this year is going to be it's a little bit of a down year on the women's side, just because there's been a lot of changes in a lot of programs, just because you don't have your Fordham that's been competitive in the past years, and your UMass aren't competitive as much. With that being said, I feel like it's going to be a very interesting season just to see how the start of the season goes for a lot of programs. We only have 8 of our teams actually starting their non-conference play up on Monday.
Wow.
A lot of them are spread out all the way to Thursday. So
what's your bold take here for women's basketball? What's going to be the driving force behind this season? Who do you think is going to come out as either the regular season champion, the tournament champion, or maybe do you see someone taking both of those this year?
I'm going to say it's going to be a tight race. David, I want you to like hop in on this, because I know you know some stuff on women's basketball too. Or a lot, probably a lot more than I do too.
No, I think you're the expert, but I feel pretty good about my knowledge, but you go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to say we're probably going to be seeing top two positions this year are going to be competing St. Joe's and Rhode Island. I'm going to say that right now. It's probably going to be St. Joe's and Rhode Island, maybe a GW, but I don't know. Those are probably your top three right there.
Yeah, I personally don't see this as a super hot take. What I think about the women's side, I think GW is going to win the conference. I think they're going to make but again, I don't see that as a very hot take. I personally have them as number two right now in my preseason power rankings behind Rhode Island, and I don't see too much separation between them. They played each other pretty close last year in the tournament. GW finished lower than expected in the regular season last year because of some off the court issues that there were some behind the scenes stuff that nothing scandalous, but they had a tough end to their season. They're returning everybody except Mia Laxtigala, and Nia Robertson's getting better. They added two players, including the Patriot League, one of the best defenders in the Patriot League, which will shift Maya Wataibo, who has been a perennial all-defensive player, to her natural position at the four, which I think will solidify GW as the best defense in the conference. And so if they're able to score more than, I think, probably 60 points a game, I think they will have no trouble beating anybody in the Atlantic 10, including Rhode Island.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this. Player of the Year running is really coming from three different teams. Rhode Island, GW, and St. Joe's.
I don't think GW is going to have a player of the year necessarily unless Nia Robertson really expands her role. But I really just am excited to see what GW can do. And I think that the top of this conference is weaker than it's been in a while, which will allow a team, maybe on the what people may consider to be on the peripheral, that could contend for a either regular season title or make a run in the postseason.
Personally, I could see either Maya
Torre.
Thank you.
Maya Torre, I should say.
I can get the last name. I just can't get the first name, and I apologize for that. Or Laura Ziegler. I could see either one of those two possibly coming in as player of the year.
I think if Duquesne does well, I think Meg McConnell with her
all-around
brother of TJ McConnell and part of the first family of Pittsburgh basketball. One of my favorite players to watch. I could see if Duquesne finishes top four, I think she's probably my favorite to win player of the year just because she'll average close to a triple-double.
Yeah. It's,
love that.
There's a whole bunch of unexpected on the women's side. I can tell you, I don't even know what to expect from Fordham on the women's side. I don't even know what to expect from my own team. I can tell you that right now. Because we only had 8 players play in the exhibition game last week. There's still only 8 healthy players. We have 13 on the team. 5 of them are currently injured. So I don't even know what those 5 are going to look like for the year. All of them have different timetables of returning. So I don't even know when we're going to see it. So this year is a really rough year.
But you know what? It's going to be an exciting year because no matter what, college basketball is back, right? I think, you know, we've talked about a lot today. We've talked about the transfer portal. We've talked about the difficulties of scheduling. We've talked about, you know, the highs of mid-major basketball, the lows of mid-major basketball. But no matter what, I feel like the consensus is that we're just hyped for Monday, right? I think we're going to try and get another podcast in later this week, either Thursday or Friday. But if not, you know, just talking about Monday through Thursday games, I just want to go around. Just give me quickly your favorite men's game that you're going to watch this week and your favorite women's game that you're going to watch this week. Starting off with you, Tom.
So I'm going to go outside of the Atlantic 10 again. I'm going to go USC Kansas State in the Las Vegas showcase because I do want to see what Jerome Tang's group looks like without Marquise Noel, without Keontae Johnson, Ishmael Massoud, and the hype surrounding USC with Isaiah Collier, Bronny James, who I know who was just announced is going to not play. We've also got guys like Boogie Ellis, who's still there. So that'll be a good Power 6 matchup. And then for the women's, I'm excited to see what the Fordham women's team does tomorrow night or today. Actually, it's Monday. We're recording this on Sunday. I want to see what Coach Bridgette Mitchell, or as she's known on Instagram, Coach B Knowing. I want to see what Coach B doing in her debut as an Atlantic 10 head coach, because she has a reputation. The last couple of years at Northeastern, she completely turned that program around. So let's see what Coach be having in store at Rose Hill on Monday.
All right, KG, what you got for us?
So I have 2 on the women's side outside of my mention of the South Carolina Notre Dame game on the women's side. So my first one's going to be the UMass St. Peter's game, which will be happening Monday night at 6 p.m. So it's really going to be the official start of the Coach LaFleur era in Amherst. So that's going to be an interesting matchup. And my other one on the women's side is going to be actually happening on Wednesday night. And then on the men's side, I'm looking forward to, of course, UMass versus UAlbany on Tuesday, just to see kind of where we're going to stand with our freshmen starting. Because we only have 5 upperclassmen scholarship players. So it's going to be really interesting to see who gets what playing time in the first game against UAlbany, who had a decent season last year.
Love that. David, what you got for us?
On the men's side, I'm excited for Duquesne-Charleston on Friday. I think that's an absolute pleasure of a mid-major match to watch. I can't wait to see that. And then I'm going to be in attendance for GW Howard and also GW Stonehill after that. But on the women's side, GW Howard, that in the doubleheader is a lot more intriguing to me, with Stonehill being one of the worst Division I teams in the country. It's a nice intercity rivalry. You know, DC, I love when the DC schools play each other, like I mentioned earlier. That one's going to be a ton of fun. And as I said earlier in this segment as well, sort of in the previous segment, I am very excited about this GW women's team. So that'll be the first opportunity to watch them. So GW Howard and then Duquesne Charleston are the 2 A-10 matchups I am most excited for.
Love it. For me, I think one that I feel like people should be watching, definitely on the men's side, is going to be Florida Atlantic versus Loyola Chicago. Loyola Chicago getting to host a Final Four team from last year. That's really cool. Obviously, Florida Atlantic is ranked number 10 in the preseason poll. We'll see how they hold that position against the Ramblers. On the women's side, I think I might have to go UAlbany versus Fordham on Friday. You know, I always love a little, you know, as much as I love like matchups like within a city, which is why I'm very happy that on the men's side, Fordham's got Columbia, Wagner, St. John's, Manhattan, all in their non-conference schedule. I think that's fantastic. I also love a little bit of in-state, you know, bragging rights games. You know, we've obviously got the New York City team, Fordham, going up against the Capital Region. So that's going to be a lot of fun. But again, a lot of good stuff in the Atlantic 10, a lot of good stuff around the country. And we've got so much more for you guys on A10Talk.com, at A10Talk on Twitter, and here on the A10 Talk podcast. So keep, you know, make sure you follow us on whatever your preferred podcast platform is, whether that be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. Keep checking back here. Make sure you follow us so you get a notification every time we post a new episode. And until then, keep watching some really good basketball. So for David Korn, Kaylee Godek, Thomas Aiello, I've been Sam Basil. We'll see you guys next time.